Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Well, today it's bananas. Not how to cook them, not how to shop for them, but instead we dig into their politics with writer Dan Coppell. He's author of the book Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Sally Schneider, the mistress of culinary sleight of hand, brings us the savory lemon, all the non-dessert ways to work with a fruit that we take for granted. Then it's one of those only in America tales. Cattle feed becomes a supermarket treat and then gets star power on high-class menus. I get challenged to another round of Stump the Cook with our celebrity stump master Christopher Kimball of America's Test Kitchen fame. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, who knew that in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, you could find some really good Mexican food?
No one. Well, yeah, I mean, I realize that many people from Mexico have spread all over the country, but somehow Scotts Bluff, Nebraska just doesn't seem to be a logical candidate to be a center of the culture.
Well, here's the logic. It's all around Scotts Bluff are beet fields. It's the home of the Great Western Sugar Company.
Ah.
And a lot of Mexicans have been coming up there since the 1920s to harvest.
To do field work.
To do field work. And a lot of them settled there. Mm-hmm. And there are Mexican restaurants in Scotts Bluff that have been there for decades and, you know, have been in the same family for many generations.
I think in Scotts Bluff alone, which is obviously a little town, I think we counted 5 or 6 Mexican restaurants within a half block radius.
Uh-huh.
And we did eat at them all, I have to tell you. And we found the best, by far the best, a place called Rosita's, which is the best because long ago, Margarita Lerma, who started it, I think back in the 30s it was, tried to speed up things in the kitchen because she was working in the kitchen. She was waiting tables. She was doing everything mm-hmm. there. And so what she did was to, when she made her tortilla chips, she would make them in such a way that she would toss them in the hot oil, in oil that was like maybe hotter than usual, rather
right.
than cook them on a griddle.
Uh-huh.
And they would puff up slightly, almost like a sopapilla. But harder and crisper, so that each tortilla chip that you get at Rosita's is not quite two-dimensional. It's more like three-dimensional
huh.
and puffy with a little bit of air in it, with a real kind of corn. It gives a little bit rather than crunches.
I have never seen anything like this in all of our travels across the southwestern United States. I think the trick of why Rosita's restaurant is so wonderful is because everything is made when you order it, whether it's fresh, I can never say this word,
buñuelo.
Buñuelos, which are the pastries topped with a dusting of sugar.
They're fried, right?
Yes.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Cheese rolled corn enchiladas, guacamole, which is absolutely fabulous, pico de gallo, which is chopped by hand.
Huh.
You just kind of look around, and here is really flat, rural Nebraska, and you're sitting before plates of 5-star Mexican food, and it is just a wonderful experience.
But can we go back to the fried corn? Because not only do you get it as chips, she uses the same technique to make taco shells so that each taco that you get there has that wonderful kind of slightly puffy, chewy enclosure rather
uh-huh.
than one that breaks. Furthermore, the house specialty is something that it's really exactly like nachos, but made with these chips. It's something altogether different. Nothing like, you know, bar food. It's,
right.
I mean, you get the chips topped with frijoles, melted cheese, guacamole, jalapenos, and there's something about the texture of these chips that puts it into a whole other category of eats.
Wait until the Doritos people hear about it.
You know, I was just thinking that, you know, every little regional food has been exploited by commercial food companies,
right.
and
yeah.
this
yeah.
hasn't. But you're right. We can expect to see it on the grocery shelves yeah. next year, I'm
don't,
sure.
Don't tell
tell them. Thanks, guys.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
I don't think anyone's listening.
Shane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you know that you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. You know how you miss the food from home when you travel? Well, South Korea's first astronaut, Ko San, on the International Space Station, has packed his bags, and the home food that he can't live without, in fact, that most Koreans can't live without, is kimchi. Fermented cabbage with chilies. Now, the problem is kimchi is odoriferous, to say the least. And according to an article in the New York Times, cosmic rays could make it toxic. Now, it seems no one thought of telling Ko San no kimchi allowed. Instead, the South Korean government spent millions of dollars to develop a kimchi that was safe for space travel. It had to be bacteria-free. Now, the problem is kimchi is fermented. Bacteria are what it's all about. Well, after 5 years of research and those millions of bucks, the solution was radiating the kimchi to get rid of the bacteria, but keeping its taste. Well, the smell factor was something else. That's only been reduced by 30 to 50%. Now, remember the bit about the moon being made of green cheese? Well, I think that aroma is going to be like a bouquet of roses compared to a couple of months on a space station with kimchi, even at 50% power. Good luck, Ko San. Few cookbook authors build confidence and spark the imagination the way Sally Schneider does. Now, where others insist that we follow rigid rules in cooking their recipes, Sally gives us the rules, but then she tells us how to riff on them. Well, her latest book is, appropriately enough, The Improvisational Cook. Hey, Sally, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn.
Sally, do you have any tricks for livening things up?
Yeah, definitely. I've got lots of them. But I would say my favorite one that I may almost overuse because I love it so much is taking ordinary lemons, which I always have on hand, even when the rest of the cupboard is bare. I use them in two ways. The first is in very, very fine slivers of zest, which I toss into things not only as a charming visual garnish, but they provide little hits of flavor, almost like a little surprise that illuminates the other flavors as well. For example, soups, just about any soup, from a composed soup where I've done some broth and greens and chicken, to stews. I braise veal shanks with lots of onions and anchovy and thyme, and I add lemon zest to that and then finish it with lemon zest. Chicken salad with walnuts and lemon zest, other salads. You know, I do fettuccine Alfredo for a quick dinner for myself, a kind of ersatz Alfredo with an egg and a little creme fraiche and Parmigiano. If I throw the lemon zest into that, it turns into a lemon pasta that is really lovely and really fast. It's an instant way to kind of transform, you know, a dish that you're struggling with to make it work.
You said something very interesting, too, that you add it as it's cooking and then you add it at the end. That idea of layering so it cooks into the dish and then you finish the dish with it so it sparkles.
I do that often. You have to be careful, though, because you don't want it to taste like lemon oil. So you're not throwing huge amounts in. And if you cook some into it and then you taste it and you say, you know, it could use a little more or a little layer on top is going to give you a fresher hit of it, it's really magic.
Do you ever use the whole lemon?
Absolutely. I love slicing a whole lemon paper thin. And then I take that slice and I cut it into little bits and I fold it into dishes because I want a little bit of fresh, tart lemon flesh along with the taste of the peel. So I do that with applesauce. I throw whole bits of lemon into applesauce just at the end of cooking when I'm taking it off the heat.
Mm-hmm.
I mix them into fruit pies, slaws of shredded root vegetables. Ratatouille is fabulous that way. And then, you know, the other day, actually, I improvised a dish. I had some fennel. So I thought I would roast it, and I sliced the fennel thinly and shallot thinly. And then I thought, why don't I roast it with some slices of lemon? Now, these were probably quarters of a whole slice. I tossed it all with olive oil, roasted it at a high heat, and it caramelized, and the lemon bits caramelized. And they somehow got a little sweeter. So it was absolutely dazzling. I actually threw in some pine nuts at the end.
Sounds pretty swell.
Well, think of roasted potatoes and roasted lemons.
I mean,
it would be great.
Sally, just going back for a moment when you talked about just slicing very thin slices of the entire lemon.
Yeah.
You have then the rind and you've got the flesh, but between the two, you've got that white pith that's really bitter. Do you use that too? I mean, doesn't that change things?
You know something, Lynn? I found that if the lemon slices, now you're talking about little bits, into a whole dish, it's no problem at all. In fact, the bitterness kind of balances things in a way. It doesn't become overpowering. That is when they're buried within a dish. Now, there's something I love, which is to make lemon sandwiches.
Lemon sandwiches?
Yeah. It's to go alongside something like a smoked salmon or other smoked fish or ham. And that is meant to be a very delicate thing. And in that case, the lemon is being featured. And lemons these days have a bigger pith than they did in the old days. So what I do is I grate or sliver some zest. Then I cut all the white pith off. Then I use slices of the flesh without any pith at all to layer onto heavily buttered whole grain bread. And I add a little of the zest, and that's my sandwich. So you're not getting the pith. So think of what your use is. With the fruit desserts, for example, you might not want the whole slice of lemon. Mm-hmm. You might just want little bits of flesh, which is totally fine. That's where it gets into kind of listening to the dish you're making and seeing really what it requires.
Hey, Sally, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of The Improvisational Cook. Now, you can get Sally's recipe for risotto with dry sherry and lemon on the website, splendidtable.org. While you're there, also find our newest development, something we're calling Splendid Cheap Eats, a collection of inexpensive recipes culled from our archive. Take a look. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, the banana as in fruit and Republic, Tater Tots Go Hollywood, and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Five 5,000 years before Christ, people were growing bananas in Papua New Guinea. It took 6,850 years for the first banana to be sold in the United States, in Jersey City, New Jersey, to be specific. Now, after that, things got very interesting and controversial. Selling those bananas tipped a set of dominoes into action that some say ended up creating today's Central American governments. At least that's part of the story writer Dan Coppell tells in his book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. Dan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dan, this term banana republic, we've all heard it, but could you define it for us?
Sure. The term means refers to the countries in Central and Northern South America that, starting around 1900, basically became vassal states for the banana companies who were building a market for the fruit in the U.S. and, in order to keep that fruit cheap and keep the supply up, had to literally take over countries ranging from Guatemala as far south as Colombia.
Now, how did they go about doing this?
Well, they did it in very brutal ways. Again, the most important thing about bananas to remember, and this is the context, is that bananas, even then, cost much less than apples, yet bananas were transported thousands of miles by ship. So they really, really had to be cheap, incredibly cheap, to beat the apples, which came from a couple of hundred miles. In order to do this, they needed to control land and labor, and they did it through force, whether it was just a few thugs assassinating someone or even through the U.S. military repeatedly at the behest of banana companies. The U.S. Army and the Marines invaded countries, broke up strikes, and overthrew governments.
This is pretty loaded stuff. I mean, wasn't there any objections to this kind of behavior?
Well, you know, there weren't a lot. I think, first of all, people didn't in the U.S. didn't know about it. Second of all, there was an attitude back then that the banana companies were actually helping these countries modernize and were bringing a better way of life. And one good example of that is that an early New York Times article basically compared the establishment of the banana republics to the reestablishment of the Mayan Empire from the glory days of a pre-Columbian Central America.
Well, what were some of the pivotal moments starting, as you said, beginning in 1900s, some of the pivotal actions that were taking place?
Well, the very first intervention was 1894 in Nicaragua, when U.S. troops occupied the port of Bluefields, which was the richest, biggest banana port in Central America at that point. Mm-hmm. And basically, the workers there were underpaid and they were upset, and so the Marines came and created trouble. There were continual interventions after that. One of the most notorious came in 1910 when a fellow named Sam the Banana Man Zamuri, who was the future chairman of Chiquita, brought a couple of thugs, one of whom was named Machine Gun Maloney, to Honduras, shot up the country, and in 6 weeks, Sam the Banana Man had installed his own personal president, thus ensuring that he had as much land as he wanted to grow his bananas.
And this is all to keep banana prices down in the supermarkets?
Yeah, that's right. And the banana was a hugely profitable industry. It was the first fruit to be marketed en masse. It was more like an early version of a McDonald's hamburger than a late version of a fruit. It was very lucrative. And you could look at the fast food model, and fast food sells for nothing, yet there are huge profits to be made. The banana industry was the same. And once these billions of dollars were rolling in, they didn't want to be stopped. They had to ruthlessly continue doing what they did.
But as administrations changed in the United States, didn't attitudes toward this kind of practice change as well?
Not really until a long while later. Even in 1954, when the banana companies overthrew a democratically elected government in Guatemala, which was the U.S. State Department was right on board and provided logistics. The approval for that invasion was signed by both Presidents Truman and Eisenhower. It was only starting in the 60s that the government began to look askance at this, but even now, there's still a sort of, you know, looking two ways. One is this is in the interests of U.S. companies and business. And number two, we don't want a lot of exploitation. But some of that remains.
Where do you see the banana market now?
Well, right now, there is a disease that's running through the world banana crop. That banana we eat is called the Cavendish. Mm-hmm. It is a fatal fungus that is incurable. And so right now, the future of the banana is really in question. The banana companies have just begun searching for some kind of answer, and it's a very tough question to answer about this fungus. People have been trying to battle it in various ways and forms for almost 100 years. So the future is really going to be whether or not these banana plantations can survive. This fungus is in the soil. If they can't survive, then the banana companies will be forced to look for new places to grow bananas, possibly in Asia, probably in Africa, where the soil is now fungus-free. So you may see a repeat in some way of the cycle that led banana companies in the early part of the 20th century to find land cheap, find labor cheap, and do what they needed to do to get it.
Dan, do banana companies still have the same kind of power today?
In some places, yes. For example, Ecuador, which is the largest banana exporting country, most of our bananas come from there. One of the perennial presidential candidates who barely lost by a couple of percentage points in the last election is the president of Ecuador's biggest banana company. Just last year, Chiquita admitted to paying acknowledged terrorist organizations in Colombia, basically protection money, to continue to be able to grow bananas in the sort of wilder areas of that place. So, yeah, there's still all sorts of shenanigans going on today.
Well, Dan, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Dan Coppell is author of Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. I'd wager that local food advocates in the Northwest don't think of tater tots as indigenous, but they are. Those crispy potato nuggets were invented on the Idaho-Oregon border from what had been cattle feed. Well, those tots went from cattle feed to kid feed to now standing front and center on menus in trendy bars and restaurants all over America. Reporter Guy Hand has the story.
Could I just get a small tater tot, and that's it?
Sure, it's going to be $1.58 at the window.
My relationship to tater tots is pretty much limited to burger joints, but Atlanta Journal-Constitution food columnist John Kessler has found their appeal to be much broader.
Because there's just no guilt. You just enjoy it for what it is, however deep-fried it can be.
Kessler set out a few months ago to learn the history of tater tots. It all started in 1954 with Idaho native Francis Neef Grigg.
He and his brother, Golden Grigg, founded the Orida Company. The company was named because it's on the border between Oregon and Idaho. Basically, he and his brother were trying to perfect a way to make frozen French fries. That was their core product. But after they trimmed the French fries, there was a lot of leftover.
They'd been feeding that leftover to cattle. But then Neef Grigg got an idea. He chopped that potato scrap, seasoned it, pushed it through holes cut in plywood, and fried it. Grigg then took about 15 pounds of this new concoction to the National Potato Convention at the fancy Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami, Florida.
He bribed his way to the head cook and arranged to have the tater tots cooked, placed in small saucers, and distributed on the breakfast tables for sample treats. And I'm reading right out of his papers. These were all gobbled up quicker than a dead cat could wag its tail amidst comments of, "Where did these delicious morsels come from, and where do we get more?"
Tater tots would soon become a staple in nearly every school cafeteria, truck stop, and frozen food section in America. That's not cattle feed. This might have been the end of the story, if not for a little movie called Napoleon Dynamite.
Napoleon, give me some of your tots.
No, go find your own.
Come on, give me some of your tots.
No, I'm freaking starved. I didn't get to eat anything today.
The Idaho-based movie kicked the tot into the 21st century and into the mouths of a new generation. Again, John Kessler.
I think it was Napoleon Dynamite who separated the tater and the tot so that it just became tots. You know, when you talk to people who are under 20 or so, they tend to say tots rather than tater tots.
That youthful sheen gave the tot what Kessler calls retro cachet. And once that happens, he says, the fine dining crowd can't be far behind.
Someone wrote to tell me about the black truffle tater tots at some restaurant in Boston.
In Washington, D.C., well-known chef Michel Richard does a foie gras tater tot ravioli.
Which just blows my circuits. I just can't even imagine what that is.
Closer to home, Leslie Kelly, a Seattle restaurant reviewer, says tots are also popping up on Northwest menus.
There is a new restaurant in Ballard called Zeta Buddies, and they have a hot dish casserole, which tater tots is featured prominently. And you don't even want to know how many calories is in that dish.
It's important to note, however, that tater tots, handled improperly, can be dangerous. Last Christmas Eve, a flaming pan of tater tots set alight a Boise kitchen. Luckily, the kitchen was located in a fire station. Returning firefighters quickly subdued the blazing tots. I'm Guy Hand reporting.
Are you going to eat your tots?
No.
Can I have them?
Guy Hand is an independent radio producer based in Boise, Idaho. Now, for a high-end version of tater tots, be sure to check out Michelle Richard's lovely book, Happy in the Kitchen, and turn to the recipe for spuddies. Divine, and some actually say simple. It's time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. Now, here's how it works. A listener calls in with five things that are in their refrigerator, nothing with green fuzz on it or anything shriveled. I have to come up with a dish from those five ingredients that the caller would really eat. And the other judge is our noble stump master, Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Chris, welcome.
I'm in a tough mood today.
Oh, boy. Here we go
again. So this is going to be a hard one.
Here we go again. Okay, Chris, who's up to play?
Well, we have Chris, and are you on the line here?
Yes, I am.
And you're from where?
St. Louis.
Okay. Let me just go over the rules one more time so we're all clear. You get five ingredients that you have on hand, plus Lynn gets salt and pepper and water. Plus, she gets three additional ingredients that you actually have somewhere in your kitchen.
All right.
Okay. All right. So what are the five ingredients?
Start off with the easy one. Goat.
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 In what form, Chris? Cooked, uncooked?
Cubed, like goat stew meat.
Goat stew meat. Okay. All right.
Collard greens.
Oh, this is great. Okay.
Farmer's cheese.
Oh, this is getting better. All right. Farmers.
Cauliflower.
Farmer's cheese. This is so healthy.
And blackberries.
And blackberries. Well, this is not a bad thing. And I have to say, this is the archetype of the public radio listener.
Absolutely.
These are all organic and local, right?
The goat is local, absolutely.
All right. Okay. From the backyard, maybe. Yes.
No, not quite that local.
Okay. All right.
Well, is this young goat or old goat?
This is young goat.
This is young goat. Okay. Do you know what part of the animal these cubes came from?
I do not. It's just from my local. There's a farmer that comes to town that brings goat. He does goat cheese and things like that. I've done curry and different things with it, and I'm just like, I need to find a reason to use goat. So here you go.
This really begs for, I think, a slow braise. I mean, with between the collard greens. Okay, I get salt, pepper, and water for free. I can't cook without onions. Have you got onions?
Oh, of course.
All right. So I want onion. I want olive oil.
Okay.
And you know what I'd like as the next ingredient? Oh, should I do garlic or should I do something really interesting and in nuts?
How about truffles?
Oh, Chris.
Come on, Lynn.
Chris, I'm sorry. You have moved far too upmarket between the television show and the magazine. I'm sorry. All right. Chris from St. Louis.
Yes.
Do you have any nuts in the house?
I have cashews and peanuts.
Ooh. All right. Let's go with the peanuts.
Okay.
This is what we're going to do. We're going to take that cube goat. You're going to take a big skillet, film it with the olive oil, right? You're going to brown that slowly, like medium heat, get it really crusty and golden brown, build up a lot of glaze in the pan. All right. Then you're going to take the cauliflower. You'll brown the cauliflower and maybe a nice big onion chopped up with that. All right?
Okay.
Because we want to get that cauliflower really brown, and because it's going to taste fabulous. In a separate pot, you're going to boil some water, all right? And you're going to throw in those collard greens.
Right.
Chopped up. Let them cook until they're tender. We're not going to think about those for the moment. Once you've got the cauliflower and the onion and the goat browned, you're going to add water to the pan, scraping up all the brown glaze that you've got.
Okay.
On his show, they always talk about brown bits.
That's right. And we've got brown bits at the bottom of the pan.
Right.
I call it a glaze.
Fond.
Yes.
Fond. Okay.
Fond.
Yes.
Yeah, we're
fond.
Doing fond.
Okay.
So the idea is that browned wonderfulness at the bottom of the pan is the whole foundation of taste. As you're doing that scraping up, you're going to throw about, 10 of those blackberries into the pan. They're going to be part of the flavoring, of this.
Okay.
They're going to add that sweet acidic note. And then what you'll do is you'll put enough water in the pan to partially cover all the ingredients, and you'll simmer until the cauliflower is absolutely soft and the goat is tender. Okay, and the onions are practically creamy. And the collard greens will now go in, and then you're going to add another big handful of blackberries and fold in the peanuts. And that's the meal. And a ton of black pepper on that before you bring it to the table.
So you wouldn't sweeten the blackberries at all?
Well, we can't because we've run out of ingredients.
Okay, excuse me.
But you don't want them sweet. You want them to be an acid-sweet accent. And by cooking them in at the beginning, you know what I'm saying, in the very
right.
beginning, and then adding up the end, you get two dimensions of their taste.
Lynn has just invented the ultimate fusion cuisine.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. All right. I'm opening myself to judgment.
You forgot one ingredient.
Which
oh,
was?
Good. Oh, good.
Farmer's cheese.
Oh, my gosh. The farmer's cheese goes on top of all of that. Sprinkle crumbles of it just before it goes to the table. But think of the creamy, crunchy, acidic, soft melting. It's going to be a fabulous dish.
I'll order two.
So are you saying I've won, Chris?
Please. I said I was in a tough mood. You're a winner. It was close, but you're a winner. Goat and blackberries. A la Splendid Table.
Oh, what can I tell you? It just... Thank you.
Did it again. Did it again.
Chris, thanks for playing Stump the Cook.
Thank you.
And Christopher Kimball, thank you for being so generous, sir.
I think this was an absolutely memorable meal.
I think so.
Christopher Kimball's day job is editor of Cook's Illustrated magazine and host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. Now, if you want to play Stump the Cook, give us a call, 800-537-5252, and leave us a message. And maybe one of our sneaky producers will give you a call and invite you to play. Okay, time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the food called Buddha's Hand? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is a Buddha's hand? Well, it's a type of citron, which is an ancient member of the citrus family. You know, candied citron for Christmas fruitcakes. Well, Buddha's hand citron looks like a lemon crossed with an arthritic octopus. It's yellow, rounded at one end, kind of like the palm of your hand. And at the other end, there are these long, thick, contorting fingers. Now, this does not sound like a winner, but once you smell Buddha's hand, you will be hooked. It is pure Arabian Nights. Think jasmine, sandalwood, and lemon. This is one very sexy fruit. Now, it was all over the place during the medieval and Renaissance periods, in dishes from meats to desserts. Just try candied citron slices with a spicy salami sometime.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
Okay, it is time for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. We have got Corey on the line calling from Nashville. Hey, Corey, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I was calling about a cake that I've had, I think, every birthday since I was about five.
Uh-huh.
It's a New Orleans cake, and I say it's a New Orleans cake because I haven't seen it or heard of it in any other city that I've lived in since I left New Orleans. And really, you can only find it at one particular bakery in New Orleans, so I'm wondering if it's a unique New Orleans recipe or if it's got a history older than that. I would assume it was an Italian cake, since it's an Italian bakery in New Orleans, a place called Gambino's.
Uh-huh. And what is the cake like?
It's called a Dobage cake, which sounds strange. It's D-O-B-E-R-G-E.
Uh-huh.
It's a multi-layered cake. It's got six or seven layers of white cake interspersed with layers of pudding and topped with a hard kind of marzipan frosting.
Oh,
and
my.
It only comes in two different flavors. It comes in chocolate or in lemon, and no other flavors. Sometimes you get a half and half cake, which is pretty unique.
Okay. Well, I have a feeling from what you're describing, I can think of two ancestors of a cake like that.
Mm-hmm.
One being Italian and the other one, I think, either being originally Hungarian, I think, but I always associate it with Vienna. And it comes, I think it goes back to the late 1800s, and it probably came out of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Dobostort or Dobosch. I'm not pronouncing it correctly. That is a very traditional recipe where it's thin layers of cake layered with buttercream and sometimes covered with a glaze. And that is classic, and it can be six and seven layers. Now, what you're describing with the use of the pudding is, by the way, is there any liquor syrup that's moistening the layers of cake? You know, like a rum syrup or something like that?
Not, I don't think so.
Okay.
Although there seems to be something that floats between the pudding and the layers of cake. It might be, but I
maybe it's a layer of jam, too. It could be.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah, it could be. Okay, in Sicily, there is a cake that is done that's called a cassata. And it is usually layers. There may be a ricotta cream between the layers. It's covered with almond paste marzipan. It can have candied fruit in it. It can have pudding in it. I grew up, personally, with birthday cakes and celebration cakes, being in an Italian family and going to they went to an Italian bakery, where it wasn't unusual to have exactly what you're describing, except that there often was a rum syrup that would be spread on the cake, and then I guess they'd put the pudding, or there was rum in the pudding, alcohol in the pudding. I hated it as a kid. I wanted a supermarket lousy buttercream cake with a buttercream made with spry. You know, I wanted to be like everybody else. But I think what we're talking about here, maybe, since they're calling it Dobage.
It's spelled Dobage, but it's pronounced Dobage.
Dobage. I would bet you that somebody, and it wouldn't be unlikely with all the French influence, because the tort from Hungary became very much a part of classical French baking,
okay.
And all the French that came to New Orleans, I would not be a bit surprised that original Dobostort came to New Orleans. A local baker, maybe someone of an Italian background, you know, this is an Italian bakery, brought their own tradition in from Italy, and the two were blended into this multi-layer cake. Or maybe it's just that the multi-layer cake with the pudding and the marzipan is just yet another version of the kind of cake I associate with Sicily. I mean, you can't say that six and seven layer cakes only come from Hungary in the 19th century. So as far as background of the cake, I would say it's probably a little bit tad more Italian.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere in its ancestry, there was philandering over the border.
In good Creole fashion.
Exactly. But I don't know that it would be a hard cake to duplicate if that's one of the things you're thinking of doing.
Oh, I don't know if I can make it at home.
Then the secret is you got to go back home and you got to
go back home.
Is the bakery still there, Gambino's? You said it was Gambino's?
They relocated to Metairie 20, 30 years ago.
Uh-huh.
But they are still up and running. They make wonderful king cakes too. But
Great king cake. Oh, yeah. Hey, Corey, I wish I could give you, you know, more definite lineage.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. Take care. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Well, we've started a project called Locavore Nation. It began when we did a survey on sustainability on our website. 15,000 people responded. Now, at the end of the survey, we asked for volunteers who would be willing to live for 1 year eating locally, sustainably, and
eating organic if possible, and that would be for 80% of what they were consuming. Well, 5,000 people volunteered, and out of that, 15 were sorted out. Now, we have one of our locavores on the phone, April Lugenbuehl. April, welcome.
Hi.
So tell me, first of all, how is it going for you?
Well, it's been a little more difficult than when I originally signed up that I thought it would be, because so much has changed from when I signed up. We're moving. My husband and I are working on moving, which means learning a whole new set of local.
Yeah, right.
And also I'm pregnant.
Oh.
So I'm finding that to meet my nutritional needs and to meet my caloric intake, sometimes I just need to eat something, whether it's local or not.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, tell us where you live.
I'm moving to Cleveland from Columbus, Ohio.
So how hard has it been now since you've moved to find local sources?
It's starting to get easier, and we're still sort of in transition, which makes it complicated, too. But I've found at least one grocery where they seem to just have every other product is either local or organic, and people have been very helpful as I get settled in and meet new people. They're very mm-hmm. wonderful about, oh, try this, go over here, look at this. And so that's been encouraging as well.
Now, is this a new idea for you, or is this something you've been doing for a while?
We've been doing it for a while. I had belonged to a CSA, a community supported agriculture group, in Columbus, and so from spring until fall, local was, and organic too, was a snap.
Right.
And then winter has always been a bit of a challenge. I've never been good about keeping up with canning, and
yeah.
and you know, I've had a limited space. When we're moving, I think we're going to have a larger kitchen space and pantry space. So I'm actually hoping a year from now to have a lot canned and put up.
So. You're a student, aren't you?
Yes, finishing up.
Uh-huh. So how does this affect the budget?
A lot.
Yeah.
Fortunately, my husband is not a student, so household income total at least can support this mm-hmm. fairly well. But, yeah, we've gotten creative. And in the end, buying local ends up being a little cheaper for us, I think, when we have access to, like, the CSA.
Mm-hmm.
But going to the store, you know, we've had to make some decisions. Do we buy organic milk or do we just buy the regular stuff because milk prices have gotten so high, you know?
Hey, thanks for talking with us, and we'll be looking for your blog.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Hey, you take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Now, you can check April's blog and everybody else's, all the 15 candidates, and you can talk to them at Locavore Nation. Just go to splendidtable.org. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have got Alan calling from Knoxville. Hey, Alan, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm a regular listener and love your program.
Thank you, sir.
I love gourmet cooking.
Uh-huh.
But I must say, even after all these years I'm an amateur, I've never had a professional course in it or anything. But I like to saute fish, and like sea bass.
Right.
And usually we'll, you know, put some flour on it.
Right.
And then put it in an egg wash and then a milk wash or vice versa. I don't know
right.
which comes first
uh-huh.
or whether it matters. Then I put it into a bag of crumbs and I shake it. Cracker crumbs usually is the seasoned cracker.
Oh, that sounds
crumbs.
Great.
And then I put it into a frying pan that's preheated and I have olive oil and maybe a little butter in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I fry it and I turn it over, and invariably when I turn it over, the breading comes off.
Mm-hmm. And it's a pain in the neck because the breading tastes so good on the fish, and it burns when it's in the pan.
Right.
I think I know what's going on.
Great.
Okay. Skip the milk.
Oh.
Yeah. You can dip flour first, a little egg, right, and then the crumbs, the cracker crumbs. Because what's happening when you dip it in the milk is the egg is the sticky stuff. The egg is one of the things, one of the ways that you make a coating like crackers adhere. And when you dip it in the milk, you're getting rid of the egg and you're getting rid of the flour.
Oh, okay.
You see? So if you do flour, dip an egg, and then in breadcrumb, you should get
you
a pretty
egg,
sturdy.
The whole egg?
The whole beaten egg.
Whole
yeah.
Egg, yes.
But I have to tell you something. If you go online to the New York Times, every Wednesday, the food scientist Harold McGee does a column. It's called The Curious Cook. And I just copied and pasted a whole series of these. They are fascinating to read.
Wonderful.
And one of the columns, and I don't remember all the details, mm-hmm. one of the columns was on how to fry a fish or anything else in a batter of flour, rice flour, and vodka.
Wow.
But he explains the science behind this and the whole science behind coating something for deep frying. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating. So what I just what I've told you is a classic way to do it. Flour, beaten egg, and then your cracker crumbs. And that'll work. But if you want to really get into the craft and the art of this and some go to Harold.
That sounds great.
Yeah, yeah. So skip the milk, drink the milk. It's healthy, you know, and go for just the flour, egg, and then the cracker crumbs. And you should have great success. Thank you, Alan.
All right, wonderful talking with you.
Hey, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You can call us at 800-537-5252. The late great musician Ray Charles left us his music. No small thing. But he left something else as well. He endowed a chair at the 131-year-old Dillard University in New Orleans. It is for the preservation of African-American foodways. Now, the first scholar in residence to hold the chair is culinary historian Professor Jessica Harris. Jessica, it's good to talk to you again.
It's good to talk to you again.
Now, why did Ray Charles endow a chair about food and not music?
Well, actually, the full title of the chair is in African American Material Culture, with a specialty in food and folklore.
Ah, okay, but still.
But
the
no. He loved to eat, and I do know because I've spoken with Leah Chase, who's like our doyenne of Creole cooking, certainly Black Creole cooking down here.
Yeah.
And she remembers him at her restaurant and remembers that he was quite the chow hound.
Why did he pick Dillard University?
Well, he was given an honorary degree by Dillard, and I think one of the things that's kind of little known about Charles is that he was extraordinarily generous, and he gave a lot of money to a lot of schools, particularly historically Black schools.
Uh-huh. So tell me, what are your plans? What do you want to accomplish?
Oh, I'm one of those dreamers. I used to say if somebody would just give me a title on the door and that rug on the floor, mm-hmm. I could come up with all kinds of things. So this is my opportunity to come up with any number of things. I think the first thing, and we're kind of in the process of trying to work on it right now, is founding an institute, and hopefully an institute for the study of culinary cultures. And there's no more perfect place for it than the city of New Orleans. And within New Orleans, no more perfect place than the school, Dillard. And that brings me to the second thing that I hope to do. I'm hoping to call in fall of 2010 the first international conference on the food of the African diaspora.
Wow. That is going to be interesting. And I'm amazed that no one has done it before this.
Exactly.
Well, you've written so much about the subject. It's a natural for you.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that were there a different scholar as the inaugural scholar in the chair, it might take a whole different approach. But I just think I like the idea of ripples in a pond and to see the ripples as they move.
Mm-hmm.
And I like making connections. I mean, it's what I have spent certainly my culinary career doing.
Yeah.
And ultimately what I spent my life doing.
And to see how those connections have shaped what we eat day to day now. This conference is going to be very interesting. We'll check in with you.
Oh, please do.
Another
please
year.
Do.
Okay.
I think, you know, I'm looking forward to it. I've got plans.
Hey, Jessica, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
You take care.
You too.
Professor Jessica Harris is the first scholar in residence to hold the chair endowed by musician Ray Charles at Dillard University in New Orleans. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Ray Charles, who said, "I never wanted to be famous. I only wanted to be great." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website,
splendidtable.org. Not only will you find our newsletter and podcasts, you're going to find information on our book, How to Eat Supper. And you can find it all at splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our program is supported by the Repossessing Virtue Project. Fresh thinking on the moral, spiritual, and ethical aspects of the economic downturn. Gain perspective on living and working at speakingoffaith.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.